blessing at a great cost had been given to them by their goddess Harmony and by the Riddler and Nicodemus and the sacred band of stepsons, to have a chance at life, to fight on other days, to carry on, to have some left who remember. Charon remembered Tempest saying this to Theagenes so long ago on that first battle plain of Chironea, the night before the massacre. And his beloved Theagenes had agreed. Theagenes and Tempest had come to terms, while the Riddler and Stealth had stood in that dream-forged chariot, and Critias and Stratton held the chariot horses by their bits. He hadn't understood it then. Now, finally, he thought he did. Wanting neither too much to live nor too much to die, he sat with his son and the best of his Thebans as they recalled their dead, everyone, and their living, wounded or hale, and prayed to the goddess to grant them grace in the days and battles to come. So if Lysis, the Blessed One, had the audacity to ask Harmony to heal and preserve his stepson partner Artan, then all the older men forgave the youth, for the young believe that anything is possible, if only a mortal soul will be just and true and have faith. In the wake of the hurricane, Tempest and Nico hunted up and down the valley everywhere they could, in search of the missing and any dead they'd overlooked. They didn't find Randall. They didn't find Jihan. They found no other bodies or wounded, no matter how hard they searched. There had to be some. They had other fighters missing in action. Sometimes men wander off, get lost, forget themselves for a time if they are hurt badly enough, or stressed highly enough. The fog of war still hung over the sacred band and would until their dead were put to rest. Finally, for one night, even Tempest had searched enough. They came back to the barracks before daybreak. But the commander was restless, cleaning his weapons. The sound of his whetstone came too fast, too angrily. Nika knew the Riddler well enough to know that Tempest had something weighing on his mind. "What is it, Commander? Can I help?" Tempest's face was turned away. "You've been wanting to see your goddess, Nika. She invited you. Go now, before the rites. I'm going to Lemuria to visit with Sime. I need to give her the heart of Ascalon. Then this is done. Until I do, it's not. I'll be back before the ceremonies." Tempest showed him the bracelet with its obsidian center. Not anything the Riddler could do would pulverize that volcanic glass or crack it. He'd let Nico try his hand at demolishing it. The obsidian stayed as it was, even when they put it in a vise and hacked at it with Tempest's god-given sword. He wanted to go with the Riddler, but Nico would not be welcomed by Sime, and he didn't want to force Tempest to say so. The commander rode out on his troth stallion soon after. When the gates closed behind Tempest in the dawn, the barracks seemed too empty, despite all the heroes crowded in there. The wounded, the dead, and the unscathed. So it happened that Nico had this time alone, a few hours uncommitted. Critias must have had orders from the commander, because Crit chased him away, saying all preparations for the rites were ongoing and Stealth would only be underfoot. When he started toward sanctuary at mid-morning, he thought he'd hunt further for Jihan and Randall. Perhaps they'd found one another and were struggling to get home. He tried this valley and that hill and the other field, but no stepsons or sacred banders or frost daughter or hazard class mage could he find. His search took him to the general's road, where he'd once found his mare. The air was full of birdsong, bright and clear. The skies above were washed clean, sparkling. When he finally admitted to himself that he was seeking out the goddess, he was afraid he'd never again find that white house down some elusive, winding path off the general's road. The goddess must live somewhere near here, mustn't she? The house with its fluted columns must be here somewhere, mustn't it? Nico and the black made good time, headed south. This horse healed like no other, worked like no other, had stamina like no horse he'd ever had between his legs. Its mouth was soft, its eyes were fiery, and it had gaits to please a god. So when he reined it to the right along the general's road and it refused, he was surprised. He tried again. It wouldn't follow the road. It wanted to take a fork he didn't recall. Finally, when he was about to get off and see if it had picked up a stone or hurt itself some other way, it turned its head toward him with an arch and reproachful look and bit his left boot. He thumped its muzzle. It let go. But then he thought that the black horse might know the way to its mistress's house. Perhaps the horse was correct, and he was wrong. The stallion clearly wanted to go to the left. He loosed his reins and gave the horse its head, and the black trotted happily down the road's left fork, past abandoned farms and fields that looked increasingly familiar, until it came to a sheltered lane where bushes with white blooms grew high on either side. When the horse turned in and started down the lane, Nico looked up. Above his head, leafy trees made a pergola against a sky of cornflower blue. A twist, a turn, and they came upon a big white house. It seemed to be the same house as before, or one just like it, set back from a circular drive strewn with pebbles. He slid off the horse. He didn't remember the pebbles from the last time he was here, but that day he'd cared only about reclaiming his mare from the woman astride her, who'd led him here. He hesitated. As he looked around, a grizzled man came from behind the house and walked toward him, whistling under his breath, dark hand held out to take his horse's reins. He shouldn't give up his horse until he knew if he had the right house. He couldn't knock on the door from where he stood with his mount. The windows, so tall, so wide, were curtained. He couldn't see in. No one could see out. The dark man had long, curly hair. Yellow teeth peeked through his lips as he waited to take the horse. "I've come to see your mistress," Nico said. It sounded foolish. Of course that was why he'd come. The grizzled man made no reply. Just then the tall front doors opened and out she came, onto her porch. Had there been only one door the last time he was here? Now there were two doors, open wide between soaring columns supporting a pediment. Harmony stood there under the pediment in a lavender linen dress, pinned at the shoulders, draping softly around her. A breeze stirred long, honey-colored hair, she said. "I was hoping you would come today, Stealth called Nicodemus, and held out her hand. He must have given up his reins, he must have climbed the stairs, he took the hand she offered him. Then he was inside the house, and cool shadows played a game with sunlight on its white, bright walls. Rooms opened off a hallway flagged with limestone. He couldn't recall if he'd been in here before. It didn't matter. He had her hand in his. Her hair swayed back and forth across her hips as she led him through halls and upstairs to a room he remembered. She said, "I hope you didn't come just to see your mare," as the door closed behind them and he leaned back upon it. Everywhere was the sweet smell of meadow. A summer breeze caressed the curtains. He was dirty and sweaty, and he wore his work panoply. He said, "I came because you said I could." "Oh, you can, Nico. You can," she said. He was hesitant. He didn't want to do the wrong thing. He didn't want to assume anything. But there was a bed in this room. She'd brought him up here, in here. He started to unlace his cuirass. She watched him, and he watched her, and eternity stretched before him in those amber eyes. He asked, taking off his work belt with its sword that surely shouldn't be here, "Am I always going to heal, as I did in this battle?" His short sword and belt hit the floor. His cuirass followed. She asked, "How long is always?" Now the goddess was close to him, so close he could reach out and touch her white skin, her silken hair, her linen dress. Her long arms were so beautiful, skin so smooth, breath so sweet. Am I eternal, immortal? "Shh," she put a finger to his lips. "You are what you need to be. Be quiet, and you can feel it. See? Now, that's better." They were standing in the middle of his gear. He looked at the goddess. She looked at him. She ran her fingers down him from the hollow of his throat, across his breast, down his diaphragm, along the line of hair there and farther down, past his navel to his groin. She'd told him to be quiet, so he didn't say a word. Wherever those fingers touched him, heat flared, muscles jumped and tingled. "Turn around, Nico. I want to see the rest of you." He obeyed. She ran her cool hands over him. She touched him everywhere he'd been hurt, stroked every place that he'd been wounded. Down his right arm where he'd taken a bolt, over his right hip and thigh where the axe had cut him, along his right hip, his right flank, his buttocks, his thigh where the abscess that nearly killed him had been. Her nails traced across his skin, where new flesh was, over all his old scars, which once were there, and now were not. "Perfect," Harmony decreed from behind him. "Now turn back to me." "Thank you, goddess," he said then, "for healing me, for saving me when I would have died. For all of it. For all you've done." Those hands had brought his body to life when he was wounded, when he was nearly dead and truly dead. Now this touch makes life burn brighter in him, and his body feels as it has never felt before. Harmony put one arm around his neck, then the other. He wanted to lift her up, put his hands around her waist. There was linen between them. Then there was not. Her lips touched his, and he did lift up this most beautiful girl. She's his dancing girl from the beach again, light as a feather, cool as a breeze. He didn't know how long they'd been here. He didn't know how long he could stay. He wanted to be with her forever, just this way. With the smell of her in his nostrils and the feel of her in his hands. He carried her to the bed, and she unwound from him all sunlight and glossy hair shifting in the breeze. "Nicodemus," she said softly, "come lie down. We have all the time in the world. The balance is restored. The heavens rejoice with us." He wanted to ask so many things. Would she stay with him? How long? Did he dare to ask? Every time he tried, the goddess put a finger to his lips and he couldn't speak. Her bed was as soft as the clouds in this room, painted like the skies above, where they had lain together once before and now again. He wants to show her his rest place. It is what he is, and what he has fought so hard to preserve. Then he's swept away with her. His rest place is full of sunlight, and she is with him there. The grass of his star-shaped meadow is so green it's nearly blue. His stream runs through it, bright and clear and clean. No blood or sorcery mars the ebb and flow that is his life. Gravel and pebbles gleam from the bottom of his stream, shapes and colors blending like days without end. Around, his trees are evergreen and proud and tall. He says, "This is my place. How is it you are here with me?" She replies, "You have brought us here, to this eternal place of yours. Do you want me with you here?" He says, "Yes, please, always." They lie there on his grass together for a time beyond counting, until a cool breeze sweeps them back to her bed again. Everything is melding together as he lies in her arms and she lies in his, past and future, swirling together, exaltation beyond what just one soul can hold. But they are two, now, here and there and everywhere. "Is this real? This place? This time? Are you really here with me?" He had to know the answers. The bed is just as soft as it had been before, the room still painted like the heavens. "Yes," says Harmony. Then he didn't need to know anything more. But when she rolled on top of him, he said, "I don't know what you want from me, what to do, what to say. Just breathe deep, beloved. So many days to come are ours. Love your life. You will be everything you wish in time. Be patient. All is in proportion for you and me." And she kissed him so very softly that all his questions flowed away, and his anger at the gods with them. Then her body wound round him, and the day spun round him, and nothing mattered more than the glory of those eyes. And when he rode out to the barracks in the gloaming, Harmony rode with him, on the sable mare, to be there for the funerary pyres of his sacred band. on the overlook above the valley where an infernal battle plain had been, two gods and a goddess must meet again. Harmony calls the meeting on this sweet-smelling ground. Theomachy has brought a strange and strained proportion, although the earthly balance is restored. Too much anger remains among these three. Too much meddling unbalances even divine souls. She wears her human aspect and green linen in consonance with the sage and heather spilling down the hillside. Enlil wears his cloak of storm cloud. His crown scrapes the sky above. And Vashenka stalks in, down a ramp of lowering cumulus, heavy with rain, ominous with lightning. He is angry. He is young. He is proud. So, speaks Vashenka, now we storm gods are summoned by a goddess. What is the purpose of this meeting?
After this battle, you have to ask. Harmony disbelieves. The fates were aroused. Stormbringer the Unbegotten vented his wrath. And who was hurt? Not we, but our faithful. And we will bring down worse if we do not cease hostilities among ourselves and tend our flocks. Gods can be struck from heaven for abandoning true believers. Destiny can be changed forever. We need to come to terms as to which of us will champion what mortals, and how much. Not fight among ourselves now that this battle is won, now that the Dream Lord is no more.
Enlil growls deep in his massive throat and thunderheads obscure the heavens. He makes himself so big he stabs the sky's belly with his crown and rain begins to fall. You did well for your believers in that battle, Harmony. Why are you so concerned?
The balance restored at so great a cost must be maintained, says the goddess, shaking her head until her long, long hair brushes the heather and the roses and the sage on the slope, so that bees take wing and hummingbirds dart skyward and dragonflies flit away. The rain stops. Enlil, you did little for your own, yet I cannot do what I'd like for them because they are yours, not mine. Vashenka, you did nearly nothing for any fighter in this battle. But you did do something for your avatar. And now once again you have adherents in sanctuary, temple-goers and priests. You are therefore implicated in any wrath we may face from eternity. What say you?
Vashenka takes a breath so deep that clouds rush across the sky. He slaps his chest and tosses his mighty head with its yarrow honey hair. Yes, I have adherents. Many now. You'll no longer treat me like a child here. I have an avatar upon the earth, and he is young and strong.
As you are,
Harmony says gently, to make an ally if she can. But Enlil is older than the hills and canny. Young storm god, you had so few in the battle. Your talk is empty, yet. Vashenka, you have a temple, a chapel, some worshippers, but you are nothing compared to me. Now Enlil puffs himself up until he is all storm clouds with raging, swirling eyes and glares balefully at the two of them. Harmony holds her blowing hair at the base of her neck, but it lashes down the slope in Enlil's wind, knocking petals from the roses.
We must cease this prideful fighting across the heavens, If we don't, worse will be forced upon us.
Vashenka says, Let the fates come and give me battle. He pounds his fists together and thunder claps and echoes. Fool, says Enlil and shrinks to appropriate size.
Fool, says Harmony and pulls her hair back from the valley, winding it around white shoulders like a stole.
So they regard each other, two storm gods and the goddess of celestial order and love in war. The sun surmounts the clouds, breaking through and shining while a persistent wind drives off the thunderheads and rainbows arch from where they stand to the far side of the valley.
Conflict must end, like this rain, in a good result, Harmony decrees.
And how will you enforce this mandate? Who appointed you Queen of Heaven? Enlil wants to know, for his own wife bears that title.
I need not be any greater than I am, says Harmony. I speak for mortals, exhausted from war and storm, facing famine next, calling out for help while you two fight between yourselves, ignoring them, except as fodder for your battles.
Vashenka laughs and deer break cover in the valley, running for their lives. Surely you don't seek peace on earth? Are you not a goddess of war? Has your dalliance with a mortal made you weak?
Nicodemus should be my avatar, she says clearly. You each have yours,
and Lil has two.
Seed me, Nicodemus, O storm god of the armies, completely, not with vengeance in your heart. Then you and I, Enlil, can and shall be allies.
So it's not peace you want, but merely one fighter sworn to my cause. He has free will. Take him if he wills it. If you and I can come to terms so easily, then so be it. Enlil waves a hand and a storm front pushes against the bright sky, all around them. I have done little for that one, your mortal toy. Or any other. But Vashenka huffs, I did more for my faithful in the battle and in the hurricane than did you, Enlil.
Let's not start this up again, suggests the goddess. I acknowledge you, Vashenka, your battle and your believers. My faithful choose. I will not pit mine against yours, or my bright heaven against your soggy one. All will have a turn in appropriate proportion.
I have so many faithful, Vashenka, on so many lands and plains and worlds, not like you, with just a few. And you, Harmony, after what you did for your Thebans, you, of all of us, Enlil warns, are at the greatest risk from angry fates. Is protection what you want from me, goddess? If so, I grant it. With a few concessions, of course, from your lovely side.
Harmony says nothing. She needs no protection, only cooperation, but this answer will suffice from a potent old god who must be better than all the others in his own eyes.
Vashenka looks and looks between the two elder gods and says, If you two acknowledge that sanctuary is mine and ask before you intervene for the sacred band or other favorites, I will bring my lightning, put my sword at your disposal when you come to me. I'll fight beside you against any predation. You will need only to ask. Enlil and Harmony look keenly at one another. This accord will never last, both know. But nothing remains the same under heaven. This young god wants to be consulted, respected, elevated above his station. Lightning climbs among the clouds, but doesn't strike to earth or flare across the sky. Nature holds her breath in an eternal silence.
I accept your proposition, Vasanka. I will not rise against you without due notice. I will call upon you, indulge your passion for concurrence.
For now,
Enlil agrees.
And I, Harmony breathes, and sunlight spreads above while heaven and nature softly sing. From their mouths comes the power of their oaths. Then it is done. She has her avatar. And a truce reigns, as fragile as rainbows and as robust as storm clouds. For now.
Enlil rumbles away, Vashanka clanks back to his heaven along his ramp of sky. Harmony stands alone in her pool of sunlight for a time. She looks upon the valley, washed clean of sorcery and bloodshed. Then she too goes her way. On his own threshold at Pinnacle House, Tempest waits while gargantuan dogs stare at him appraisingly from between huge oaken doors, and a pock-faced servant informs Simmy, evening star of Lemuria, of his arrival. He considers committing various pleasant mayhems, but this is Simmy's game, after all. Behind and around him, everything in the citadel of Lemuria is as it should be. Cyclopean walls, forbidding and tall, gate guards and sentries well positioned. When he hears someone coming, he is counting the red and black stone tiles on the foyer floor.
"Evening star will see you, sire,"
says the servant, now bowing low. The two dogs growl, and then there are six swirling around his legs. Even for Simmy, this is an ominous show. He curls his fingers around the shark-skin hilt of his sword and goes meekly behind the servant, although this is his place more than hers. He fought for it, claimed it, and brought her here to rule as she deserves. Inside, glass walls still tower. Balconies stretch, angles tease the eye. Indoor trees reach toward the roof above so high. Multicolored streamers hang from rafters, battle standards from forgotten wars. Simmy comes to meet him there in silk and leather jerkin, doeskin leggings. Her hair is bound up, her gray eyes are cold, she stands by the hearth and waits. Her hands are on her hips. She's armed. He closes the distance. When he's close enough to her that he can see the moisture on her lips, he says, "I brought you this, if you had destroyed it when you could a decade ago. Think of the lives we could have saved." He digs out his grisly gift from his belt's pouch, the bracelet called the Heart of Ascalon, encircling a chunk of wrist. The two will not be separated. Wrist and bracelet are connected by artery and sinew. The Heart of Ascalon has an obsidian jewel at its center. She doesn't say a word, just stares at him, then at the bracelet in his hand. You need to destroy it now, he continues, wishing he didn't need to say what next he must. I can't. I tried. Nico tried. It may be that only you can. He holds it out to her. For many years, Sime was a free agent, a slayer of sorcerers by profession. Now she may be the last of those left alive. If anyone can do this from knowledge all but lost, it is she. For a moment he's not sure she'll take it. All their striving these many years since she's come back to him has been warped by Ascalon, this bracelet and this stone. The look on her face is one he's never seen before. She is the most beautiful woman in the world to him. Down the centuries since they first met, no other touch has excited him as hers does. No other eyes are as wide. No other mouth is as fetching, despite all their years and all their hardship. He always wants to kiss the disappointment from that mouth, erase the shadows from her eyes. He gave her everything he had when they were young. He took on a curse for her, fought a sorcerer for her, and went to his knees before a god for her. He's given her everything again, in Lemuria. For too long, Sime only looks at him, and at the grisly trophy he offers her, and finally sighs. Hold it out, then. But by the flesh, not by the bracelet. He does. She reaches into her hair with its streaks and stars of grey and takes down the diamond rods with which she's done so much good and evil over time. In two steps, she's beside him. She taps her wands together at their tips three times. They spark and sparkle. Now don't touch any of the metal. I know this ritual, but it's been a very long time. And Sime begins to sing. The song is older than both of them. So sad and soft and low. She sings as she brings the tips of the wands into contact with the obsidian jewel. The wands seem to tremble. The obsidian begins to bleed. The wands sparkle brighter. The volcanic glass bleeds and bleeds. She sings and sings this primal song of a world's early dawn, when sorcerers and gods vied for everything and everyone. He nearly drops the bracelet. It's heating before his eyes, threatening to scald him. The tips of the wand seem to sink into the obsidian, so black. The black glass has veins now, white and red and pulsing, and the quantity of blood coming from that chunk of gemstone clasped around a dead wizard's wrist is far too much for a jewel, or even a man, to hold. Blood drips and streams, then gushes onto the red and black tiles at their feet. She stops singing. The obsidian heart cracks and crumbles and drops in shards from its bezel. The silver of the bracelet is too hot to hold. He can feel the heat although he's not touching the metal. The flesh and bone he's grasping grow gooey, grow dry, and at last drop away to powder. So hot that it's glowing, the silver bracelet clatters to the floor. He kicks it out of the blood and powder. It skitters across the tiles. She still says nothing. She stares at the blood and the powder on the stone. The floor is slippery with so much blood. Then she looks at him, tears in her eyes, shaking her beautiful head with her hair falling around her face. So much death, so much pain, so much grief. I'm sorry. And she comes into his arms, stepping through the remnants of the heart of Ascalon on her palace floor. He's astounded. Is this really Simmy? No scathing remarks, no cutting tongue barbed with hurt, no aspersions, no slurs on his character. He puts his arms around her as gently as he can, and she weeps there while he holds her. Long, wrenching sobs shake her whole body. A dog howls in the bowels of the palace. Others take up the cry. The dogs sing a long and complex dog song. Sometimes they're men and women, sometimes servants, but from the number of throats singing, most must be dogs today. Tempest and Simmy stand that way until she slumps against him. He catches her before she falls and helps her to their chamber, with its white bed and white floor. He's left a trail of bloody footprints behind. She buries her head against his chest. She won't look at him. She won't speak. She took Ascalon as her husband once to save them all from his depredations for a time. She'd given even that, but never was able to destroy him. They didn't talk about the time she'd spent with Ash. They didn't talk about his lovers. This room had once belonged to a woman named Kiara, the former evening star, and it still had the same bed with a white coverlet and 100 pillows. Simmy lies down on that bed and looks at him at last. I was so angry when you left with those boys of yours with your heart still not healed. To sanctuary where only a fool would go, I thought. Looking for trouble, I thought.
I know, he said. If he sat on her bed, he was going to get it covered with the blood that had run down his arms and his hips and his legs as he held the wrist of Ascalon. Now she has, finally, finished what she started and destroyed the talisman that gave the Dream Lord his infernal power. She bit her lower lip. He remembered Simmy anew, this girl for whom he'd fought a wizard and lost that fight so long ago. And from that, when she'd come to him to save her and he'd tried, their shared curses had come, and all the lessons of their lives followed, as the thunderbolt steered all things through all things and everything came into being out of strife for them.
"Still cursed with me," she said, sniffling, running an unladylike hand under her nose. "You're not getting out of this so easily."
"This?
Me? Us?"
She put her fist to her mouth and bit her knuckles. From behind the fist, she said,
"I was so frightened for you this time. That god of yours is senile, careless of you, a wastrel."
"I know," he said. Her grief was nearly overwhelming, so long pent up inside. It washed over him in waves. If he wept before her, shed one tear, his life would not be worth living. He thought of how many times she'd taunted him, taken other men to hurt him, played the harlot to provoke him, even whoring among his stepsons. It was her curse, then, to take any man for pay, to turn away from love on pain of showing all her awful years. Together they had managed to free her from that curse, and him from his, but it had taken 3 centuries and more to do it. "Sit down," she commanded, and slapped the bedside near her thigh. She was shivering. He unfastened his chlamys and tried to put it over her. She struck away his hand. "Now what? Are you finished with your sacred band of killers in sanctuary? Done with warring? Done with slaughter there?"
"No. You know that. We have Lemuria for a purpose, to keep all things in proportion. We will do as we have always done here. Pick our battles. War as is fitting. Restore balance, deliver justice, dispense mercy when we can." He chuckled a little, hoping to make her stop shaking, but that made things worse. She knew his kill smile when she saw it.
"You took so many of your fighters, I thought you'd done with this place and me, and left me nearly defenseless."
"That's not true. You never are, or will be."
She sat up. She wound her hair up with her rods. She sniffed. "I want my 3rd commando fighters back. You took so many of them, and too many stepsons. The Evening Star should not be without a force."
"Come down to Sanctuary and get them."
"No," she said. "Not there. Not ever again. What of your pretty stealth called Nicodemus? Where is he?"
"Nico? He's where I left him, doing what he's supposed to do."
"And what might that be?"
"Becoming the hero he's destined to be. He may outstrip us both in time." "Goddesses have been known to make gods of their earthly lovers. The goddess Harmony told me, 'Use him wisely. Few have been given such a weapon by the gods or fates before.' He saved me several times in the battle with Ascalon, keeping Ash's wizard boy from mixing in, keeping spears from my heart and my head on my shoulders."
"You jest. A delinquent.
That street fighter with delusions of spirituality."
"Speaking of delinquents, how are my son and daughter?"
"Kama and Cyrus? On another mission. For me. You're not the only one with sorties underway." Then he tired of the game. She was what she was, what she'd always been. He needed to stop thinking about Ascalon, the lord of dream and shadow, and what had been between Ash and Simi. And so did she.
"You're not upset about the 3rd or Nico. It's the Dream Lord that's bothering you. Ascalon is truly and completely and forever gone, with the destruction of the heart of Ascalon, correct?" He never should have allowed Ascalon to claim her, even for a year. He had no inkling of what she had been through at Ash's hands.
Now again she shivers. Gone, well and truly gone. Dead beyond resurrection. I was so sure I'd never see you again.
She flew across the bed into his arms in a flurry. She kissed him with those lips he loved better than any others. She curled into his lap, and she said,
Promise me you'll never leave again unless you're well. Unless I agree. Unless we both concur.
You know I can't do that, he said.
I'm going to kill that god of yours next. Then we'll see what you can do and what you can't.
Don't bait the god, Simmy. Not now. Not ever. Please.
Then he stripped her and let his body make promises he could keep. She was all he'd ever loved, all he'd ever wanted. They came together and blew apart, over and over. Her passion was a match for his own. It always had been. But sometimes great passion creates great trials. She climbed him and wrestled him and surmounted him while outside her window the sun beamed down and the seabirds wheeled above Pinnacle House. Not until much later did he try to explain to her why he couldn't stay. And she was at first wroth, then disconsolate, but she wouldn't come back with him to Sanctuary.
I could refuse to grant you passage, she threatened him as he girded on his sword.
You would never do that. You are Evening Star of Lemuria. By my good offices, you will do, as you always have, what is right.
Don't you bring that Nicodemus back here.
I will, when it pleases me, and you will welcome him. Perhaps you'll meet his goddess. It's about time you met a female you can't disrespect. Or do you not still love all of this?
He waved a hand, purposely dismissive, at the strength and grandeur of Lemuria out their bedroom window.
Perhaps you'd like a simpler life. You could knit, raise sheep, become mortal. Live a short and foolish life with no care for anything but yourself.
You wouldn't dare.
And that was true enough. You're correct, he said. I wouldn't want to have to rescue you from sorcerers again, should you find any that you or I haven't killed.
And she came in under his arm then. She fit him perfectly. They walked together through the halls of Pinnacle House, past the servants and the dogs. Outside, through the tall walls of glass, he could see the stables, the citadel battlements. He could hear the sea beyond. When they were ready to part, she said to him,
"You know it's not the killing or the warring that bothers me. It's how high you're reaching now. Please come back to me in one piece this time. No more cheating the fates. As you say, greater dooms make greater destinies. We will pick our targets more carefully from now on. I promise."
She looked into him, past his eyes, into his soul.
"Now you promise."
But he couldn't do that, so he said, "I'll send our third commander home to you, all but Sink. Be good to my fighters. They were valiant. They fought well, but we lost too many this time."
She rubbed her arms.
"Life to you, Tempest," Simmy whispered. "An everlasting glory."
He'd never expected to hear those words pass her lips. So he stopped them with his own, before she could say anything that would make him love her less, since at that moment there was nothing, not even his own life, he loved more. End of chapter 44. Chapter 45, The Way Up and The Way Down.
When the pyres burned high against the evening sky, and the words all were said for the Thebans, and the gifts all were thrown on the flames for her two souls destined for glory, then the goddess Harmony took her honored faithful away to heaven, and stood by, head bowed. Then down came Abarsus from the skies for the stepsons and the third commando, all 12 souls. Tempest called the roll of the dead from the greater sacred band, while Nico stood beside him, with gifts of arrows and locks of manes and tails. One by one, Nico threw the arrows, then the forelocks, then the tail hair on the flames for each of their beloved friends and comrades. And there were tears on the beautiful face of Abarsus, patron shade of the sacred band, and on the faces of seasoned fighters, this night, as the original stepson stood in the blaze with so many of the slain, one after the other. Seeing tears on the beautiful face of Abarsus made Nico brush his own eyes with his hand. Too many deaths, too close together, against an inhuman enemy. Too high a price, even in so just a cause as an end to Ascalon, the lord of dream and shadow, Tempest thought. No wonder Abarsus shed a tear. When the shade held the last soul in his arms, Abarsus looked out from the fire at Tempest and Nico and at Sink, openly weeping for his dead warriors, and smiled through his tears. And the soul smiled too, on his way to eternity, safe now from all harm, caught up in the arms of the slaughter priest. From the middle of the flames, Abarsus arose without a word, leaving the stepsons alone in the night with their grief and their joy that the gods still loved the sacred band and sanctified their battle and the spirits of their fighters.
Godspeed, Abarsus.
It was difficult tonight, Tempest thought, as Nico watched his armored goddess with her faithful crowding round her. Next time, he might let Charon's Thebans have mourners' processions for their dead, as Thebans were wont to do. For there would be more dead. In the sacred band there always were. Other dead on other nights, stretching out eternally. Today they had buried the enemy corpses strewn across the valley in limed trenches, mass graves for Ascalon's warriors and for the Dream Lord himself. Ash would rest with his fighters, every dreamer, every soul. This night was not for celebrating or playing pipes and flutes, but Theban pipes and flutes wafted through this gentle dark where the goddess stood and then did not. Once Harmony had disappeared, Nico walked among the stepsons, touching this one and that one, somber and sober or smiling his slow smile, depending on whom he met. They still had so many missing, presumed dead. So many stepsons were too weak to walk to the pyres, too badly wounded to participate. Tempest had decreed that stepsons be brought out on litters in order to attend, if they were conscious and could be moved. Critias was sitting on the ground beside Stratton. Strat was still healing. Not yet as strong as once he was, but better, so much better. Nico's goddess is just and full of mercy for the deserving. Next to Strat lay Artan, with Lysis tending him. Artan, the seer, and his Theban partner, the sacred band's youngest bear, were wounded but steadfast with sparkling eyes. And 11 others were there on litters, so many. Despite